The meeting will come to order. We do not have a quorum, but I think to be fair to the three bill authors that we have up today, we're just going to have to start anyway. And so we'll approve the minutes before when we do get a quorum. But members, in your packet, you have the testimony from the hearing that we had in North Minneapolis. We had promised that the people who could not be heard due to time would have a chance to send in written testimony, and they have, and we thank Liz very much for putting this together in such a nice form so everybody has a chance to read it. Representative Thiessen, if you could come forward. I apologize that the members are so slow. You heard me tell them to get over here as fast as possible to hear your bill. But I think that we can start, and they'll catch up as they get here. And welcome to the committee. I would move House File 129 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And Representative Thiessen, I understand you have an amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair. On line 3.6, I would just strike the $4 million and put in a blank appropriation amount there.
Okay, so that's a friendly amendment from Representative Thiessen to his own bill, and you're just incorporating that. Members, on page 3, line 6, just strike the $4 million and leave it a blank. And then, Representative Thiessen, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill is an attempt to get at something I think is important for us to think about as a state, and I just like to tell kind of two experiences that kind of led to it, and then I'll explain the bill a little bit. The first is a tour I took a couple years ago at Johnson Elementary School here in St. Paul, and I think some of you probably have been up there to look at that as well, but they have done a great job up there of creating basically a new school in a relatively difficult neighborhood. And as part of that, one of the things they've done is they've brought in community partners to work with them. So there's a YM or YWCA attached to it. There's a clinic actually in the school that's an independent clinic. And they have space available for outside groups to come in and tutor kind of outside of the school curriculum basically. So it's become more of a community center there, and they've gotten great results doing that. So that's one thing. The other thing is in Minneapolis, a few years ago, and it's probably going to be coming here again in the next year or so, there was some schools closed and discussions of closing even more schools. And one of those schools was in my district, but I think this is true generally from talking to people who are involved in that discussion. It's probably happened in many of your districts as well. One of the things that came out of that for me that was really that has stuck with me, and I think it's common sense, but it brought that to kind of bring it home, was that schools are often more than just a building for education, and they are often forming a catalyst for a community, whether it's a rural community, I think, or in the case of a city like Minneapolis, a neighborhood. And that was certainly true with Kenny School, which is the school slated to be closed in the area that I represent. And I heard a lot from neighbors about, even if they didn't have kids going to the school, it's important that it's there and available to the children in the neighborhood and available as a community resource. And so when a school closes, it really often tears the heart out of a community. So the other aim, I guess, of this legislation is to try to recognize that somehow, not use general education dollars that we spend, you know, the pupil dollars and all those education dollars to do this, but maybe find another source of state funding to match with local funding and community funding, nonprofit funding, to help sustain those schools that maybe have a smaller population than would otherwise sustain them. And so that's basically the idea of this, to kind of let the community participate a little bit more and support those efforts as a state, because I think there is a value to our state of keeping our neighborhood strong and our community strong. So those are kind of the two places this is coming from. Basically, this sets up a grant program using state funds to match community funds. One of the things I found out as part of that school closing process, too, and I think it was also true at Johnson, is that changes need to be made to the infrastructure of the building, and maintenance expenses, et cetera, have to be there to allow for some of this co-location and co-partnership. So what this would do would use some state funds to match local and community funds, And it has to be at least a 50% match, so the state would never pay more than 50% of the amount of this work. To renovate a school, to allow some of these nonprofits that actually enhance the educational experience of the school and of the community to come in and share the space, which brings down, you know, over time, brings down the overhead, because those overhead expenses then would be shared by the school district and also by the nonprofit or whoever the community partner is. So in a nutshell, I guess that's the gist of the bill.
Thank you, Rips and Peace, and very nice. I'm just going to remove your bill because we now have a quorum, and we did not when I first moved it. So I would move House File 129 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And then just to repeat, on page 3, line 6, we have struck the amount $4 million and replaced it with a blank, and Representative Thiessen incorporated that into his bill. Are there any questions for Representative Thiessen? Any public testimony for or against House File 129?
All right.
Holy mackerel.
Well, thank you, members, and for hearing the bill and listening to this idea. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and I will just say I have toured John A. Johnson School and some of the members of the Mental Health Caucus. We took a tour there last year, and it is a very nice co-located service and definitely a building that's in nicer shape than it was when they started. So,
thank
you very much, and we'll lay this bill over for possible. Pardon me. Oh, Representative Thiessen, we do have one question. We do, please. The question is, do you care if your bill is funded through bonding money or through general fund money? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A good question. This actually was a bonding proposal last year, and so we could do it as a bonding proposal this year. I'm not sure of the, or next year, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
The only questions I have, and I certainly have to talk more about this, is the operation and maintenance expenses are also part of this. I'm not sure if bonding covers that. And I suppose because of participation of the school district, there's no issues with having nonprofits also participate. So there's deep technical questions I have, but I think you could work it either way.
We'll keep working with you then.
Thank you very much.
And now that we do have a quorum, Representative Detmer, would you like to, have you read the minutes? Would you like to move them?
Madam Chair, I so move.
Representative Detmer has moved approval of the minutes. Are there any questions or corrections? Okay, for the minutes for February 8th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Representative Carlson, you just walked in and you're up. Good timing.
Madam Chair, that is.
And Representative Carlson, do you have someone to move your bill, or would you like me to move it?
That would be fine if you'd move it, Madam Chair.
All right. I will move House File 329 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Welcome, Representative Carlson. It's very natural to see you here in this room, and please proceed.
I did spend a little time in here for quite some time. Madam Chair, this is a bill that would allow the intermediate school districts to engage in short-term borrowing, and it would, in essence, empower them with the same rights in that regard that other school districts already have. And there will be testimony from, I think, two of the three intermediates that surround the Twin City area as to the need, but essentially it's to give them some relief when needed with cash flow issues like other school districts sometimes experience. So I have Connie Hayes, Superintendent of Intermediate District 916, and if you want to go first, and then we'll, and you are, you're Christine Carr. Okay, just had to double check me, and I just walked in with who my witnesses were.
We took you by surprise. Superintendent Hayes, welcome to the committee, and if you could restate your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Connie Hayes, Superintendent of Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District. For the purpose of letting the committee know who we are as a school district, I'll just give you a very brief overview of who the intermediates are. So on behalf of my other two colleagues, back in the 1970s, the legislature approved the formation of three intermediate school districts in the metro area, one in the on the west side, one on the east side, and one on the south side of the metro. Think of the intermediate school districts as area agencies that provide services to member school districts. 916, for example, has 11 member school districts surrounding the White Bear Lake area. Those school districts send revenues to us based on the services that we provide for the students that they send to us. So we don't receive any direct levy money from the taxpayers. We don't receive direct aid from the Department of Education. All of our revenue sources come directly from the districts that we serve for the students that we serve on their behalf. I think I'll pass it over to Christine Carr.
Ms. Carr, welcome to the committee, and could you state your name for the tape, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Christine Carr. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for Northeast Metro Intermediate District 916. As Ms. Hayes was saying, all of the revenues from an intermediate district come from tuition bills and fee-for-services that we provide for school districts. Currently, the three intermediate districts have a combination of 32 member districts, but we service over 100 school districts throughout the state of Minnesota. So we do serve a broader student body than just the Metro Intermediate District members. Currently, we have no ability to do any kind of revenue or aid anticipation borrowing, so that when we come into a situation where we have a cash flow issue, our only source of cash flow is actually to go back to our member districts and ask them to advance us funds. Or we currently work under a system where we pre-bill in advance tuition payments so that we can have our cash flow to keep us going throughout the year. Two things that we have issues with this, the part where we go back to our member districts and ask them for help with cash flow is becoming increasingly difficult with the stretched financial capacity of our members. Many of them have tried to pass levies and have been unsuccessful in recent years, and it's becoming more and more difficult for them to help us. Our other option is we can keep our fund balance high, which, again, is a very difficult thing to do in the environment that we're working in. Another issue that's impacting us this coming year is the tuition billing. Currently, we pre-bill a quarter at a time so we can keep our cash flow going. With the changes in the special education tuition, the state of Minnesota is going to take that process over, and we will no longer be able to pre-bill for our special education tuition. And we will also be subject to the 10% withhold, which we've never, of course, been subject to before. The 10% withhold for the intermediate districts will range from about $1.5 million a year to $3.5 million a year. So you can see that that would be quite an impact on our current cash flow situation without any relief in this bill.
And so that, Madam Chair,
Representative Carlson,
conclude our testimony. And essentially, the mission of the intermediates, two main missions, the secondary and vocational, and as was mentioned, special service or special education services to the member districts, plus others. It's kind of interesting, you mentioned 100 school districts that ultimately utilize the intermediates, so they do have a rather broad constituency in that regard.
Thank you very much, Representative Carlson, and testifiers. And now, members, is any questions? Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm a little bit worried about taxation without representation. Who would pay the interest on this?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Carr.
Madam Chair. All of the operating expenses of an intermediate district get put into tuition billing, so this would be another operating expense, or it would be part of the membership fee paid for by our member districts. Non-member districts that send students to us are assessed an access fee, so if it's not something that's eligible for tuition reimbursement, it would be assessed to people that utilize our services.
And maybe you'd like to explain, too, who serves on your board and that sort of thing.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Carr.
Each intermediate district has a school board, and it's made up of representatives from the member district's school board, elected members from the member district school board. So, for example, on my school board, there's 11 member districts, White Bear Lake, Roseville, Stillwater, etc. Each individual school board sends an elected school board member to serve on our school board. Does that make sense?
Representative McFarland, did you ever serve on that intermediate board?
I did not serve on the intermediate board, but I was on their foundation board for nearly 10 years with the 916 Foundation. I speak in favor of this. The two women that are testifying today are great representation of the intermediate school districts in the state, the three of them in the metro area.
And I would say, when I was on the Roseville School Board long ago, I managed to never serve on the 916 board because they didn't get any extra pay, those who did, and it was very heavy duty because those members put in a lot of time and had some difficult issues to deal with. But I know that they always reported back to our regular school board meeting, so we had a lot of information on it.
Representative Carlson. I mentioned on the taxation question, as was pointed out, there is a fee paid. The intermediates at one time did have a local levy. They no longer have that. So the question about taxation would not really apply because it is elected school board members who serve. 287, which is the Western suburbs, which isn't here today, that's 13-member districts. Their board, if I recall, consists of 26 members, two from each school district, unless that's changed recently. And then they have an executive committee that meets more frequently than the larger board does for their governance purposes.
Representative Heidberg, and a follow-up, and then we have Representatives Dabney and Demmer.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. The two questions. You used to have the levy authority. And I would think that with the school, the intermediate school, that would be very important that you have the discretionary levy available for you, or at least for the school districts to get some of the things that you really do need in those school buildings. But yet, my major question is this, Representative Carlson. Does this have the approval of the member school districts that belong to this?
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, the bill was brought to me by the district 287, 916,
and
917. Unless the witnesses have an answer to that question, I'm not sure.
Superintendent Hayes.
Yes, Madam Chair. All three boards of the intermediates have approved this moving forward to the legislature, as well as the superintendents of each of our member school districts. So we have a wide support from the elected bodies as well as the administrators of those districts.
Okay, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And two questions, actually, for the testifiers. One, I note on page 1, line 21, you're proposing allowing the intermediates to borrow up to 75% of the things in lines 17 through 20. That strikes me as an awful lot of money. And I'm wondering if you can help me with, am I right, that's an awful lot of money? Isn't that kind of the sum total of the revenues you receive? How did you arrive at the 75%? And if you'd like, I can break these into two separate questions.
Who would like to take that one? Superintendent Hayes.
Madam Chair, I'm recalling from my superintendency as a K-12 superintendent that it's very typical for the Department of Ed to have that range of borrowing available to a school district. The revenue source would obviously be different for the intermediate as compared to the K-12. But I think the value that was put in the bill there is meant to be very similar to the value that's available to a K-12 district.
And Representative Dabney, I have just got very good advice to my right here, and two to my right, and that is identical language to what regular public schools can borrow. So this is all, as Representative Carlson said, just giving to intermediates what all regular school districts already have.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'll put that down as what I've learned today. you're supposed to learn something new every day, and that there it is. So add to the list. Second question on the back. This obviously is new language, and I'm surprised. Do you currently submit your membership fees and tuition payment receipts to the commissioner for, in the current case, for approval at this time? It strikes me as you're giving the commissioner an awful lot of power over your revenue, and I'm wondering if you could speak to that.
Superintendent Hayes.
Madam Chair, we do not currently have to submit, other than through our regular auditing process, what our revenues are. Again, the language is very similar to what's available to K-12, and I believe the commissioner also has the authority to reduce the borrowing for a K-12 down from the 75%. So, again, it's equal to what's available to our K-12.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do understand aid anticipation. I think we used to do that all the time with our schools. And, in fact, I think there were some years, Madam Chair, we actually made a little money on it, if I'm not mistaken.
Representative Demmer, was that legal?
It was consequential, not on purpose. It just happened to turn out that way, Madam Chair. But my question is, intermediate school districts have been around for quite some time. Why now? You've been getting by all these years without being aid anticipation. Why now?
Representative Carlson.
I might be able to answer that in part because my reference to local levy. At one time, the intermediates had their own local levy and functioned much more akin in that regard to a school district. The decision that was made by the legislature in the early 90s that be changed, that they would have a fee-for-service reimbursement through the member districts. And I think that's probably what drives the issue now, that they don't raise the revenue in the same sense that they did at one time.
Ms. Hayes, you look like you'd like to add to it, or am I wrong?
Yes.
I was looking at Ms. Carr, but Superintendent Hayes, or Ms. Carr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other issue that's in particular for this year is the state taking over the special education tuition billing process. That's well over half of the revenues for each intermediate district. And we usually pre-bill that a quarter ahead to take care of cash flow. We'll no longer be able to do that, and we'll also be subject to the 10% withhold. So we'll have a huge impact in that area for us.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When did that happen? Just like last couple of years?
Madam Chair, the legislation went into effect in 2005. In this school year, it's being impacted to the K-12 school districts. We asked for a waiver for 1 year to prepare for the new tuition billing process, and it will become effective for us July 1st.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions? Is there any testimony from anybody in the room? All right. Well, then, thank you, Representative Carlson and testifiers, and your bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
And finally, we have Representative Rood. And we're going to have one of the co-authors, Representative McFarland, up there too. And since you're on the committee, Representative McFarland, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, I would. Madam Chair and committee members, I'd like to move House File 360 for inclusion in the K-12 omnibus bill.
All right. Thank you very much, and welcome to the committee, and Representative Rood.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm going to keep my comments brief because we will be showing you a very powerful video. I know some of you were able to see this last session. There are a number of new members, and we will show it so everybody can see it. It's called Somewhere Else. It's queued up right now, and it was intended for policymakers. House File 360 seeks to allow intermediate school districts to access state school levy through their member districts. There are we have three intermediate school districts, 287 in Hennepin County, 916 in the Northwest Metro area, and 917 in the Southwest Metro area. They have membership from 32 metro area school districts. The three independent school districts were formed in the late 1960s at the request of local school districts, and they provide special education, secondary, vocational, and area learning center programming for their member districts. The delivery model was intended to eliminate low-enrolled, costly programs and services offered in individual local school districts and replace them with higher-enrolled, more cost-effective programs and services at one or more of the intermediate school district sites. Currently, they cannot access the safe school levy. And now I would like to introduce the superintendent of Independent School District. I'm sorry, I keep saying that. Intermediate School District 287, Sandra Lewandowski. Dusky, I said it wrong, I'm sorry. Who will give you more information regarding this bill and why it's necessary. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Superintendent Lewandowski. Is that right?
It's very good, thank you.
Not quite, though, so we'll listen to you say it yourself for the tape, and welcome.
Very good. My name is Sandra Lewandowski. I'm the superintendent of Intermediate District 287. And thank you for this opportunity today to talk about a very sobering issue. Madam Chair, when we hear of school shootings at Red Lake or the Amish Community School or Columbine, one of the first questions we ask ourselves as leaders is, did we see this coming and could we have prevented it? One of the realities we believe we are seeing in intermediate school districts are that a number of policy shifts and funding cuts over the last few years are resulting in violent students, unlike those that we have seen before, come to us in higher numbers and a more significant profile of violence. We felt strongly about this last year when we raised the Safe Schools Levy to the legislature, and even since that time, as a school superintendent, I am seeing an even more significant profile of violence from kids coming through our school doors. We put together the video somewhere else to talk a little bit about the realities we see, and I'd like to show it to you as background information for this hearing. I would suggest to you that there is a number of segments where there is profanity and would alert you to that in advance.
We want to educate the community at large and policymakers about the very real issue of children's mental health in our schools. And provide solutions that are successful for kids and safe for staff. When a high-need student enters our program, we often hear from the public, why isn't that student somewhere else? It's important for policymakers to understand that somewhere else is now our public schools. Intermediate District 287 is a consortium of 13 West Metropolitan School Districts. One of our major missions is to serve high-need special education students for our members.
The characteristics of our students are represented in some very alarming statistics. 90% of the students that we serve in our programs have been diagnosed with a mental health disorder. 86% of our students are currently receiving co-located mental health services. 70% of our students are currently taking psychotropic medications, and 57% of our students have been served in residential placements. 10 years ago, District 287 had two or three programs that were available for students with emotional and behavior disorders. Now, students that are referred to us are so much more complex and challenging in terms of their profile and their characteristics that we've had to create a multitude of customized programs that not only respond to all the behavior disorders, but the challenging multiple diagnoses, the psychotropic medications they need to be on, kind of environment that they need to be educated in, the types and number of staff that are required to get them through the day. So the whole picture of our division of special education looks very different today than it did 10 years ago due to the very different student population we're being asked to serve.
A lot of the students are coming to us, not just with aggression issues, but a variety of mental health issues, ranging from depression to anxiety disorders, all the way to conduct disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. At times we see students with schizophrenic symptoms. We have a student right now that is pregnant, that is an emerging schizophrenic, that is not medicated. And every day she walks in our building and has a difficult ride on the bus. She has a difficult time at the door. She comes in and she's screaming. She won't go to class. She is making accusations about someone touched her, someone kidnapped her, we're trying to make her lose her baby. And so we are trying to manage a female that is pregnant with mental health issues, and so many of those things are out of the realm of what we can do in an educational facility. We don't have security guards here. We don't have psychiatrists on staff, and we don't have the ability to say, this person has paranoid thinking, let's give them a particular med that can combat those particular symptoms.
One of the cases that I'm involved in right now with the suburban school district comes to mind. The student is, I think, as a lawyer, a very dangerous individual. He has repeatedly threatened to kill teachers. Most recently, he asked another student to prop open a lunchroom door so that he could sneak in during the lunch hour and kill two other students. This young man, whose characteristics really suggest a Columbine kind of situation, is in the community without mental health support, and the school is really struggling to attempt to provide him with some education.
Public schools have an obligation to see every type of child. Other entities do not. There can be many reasons to turn children away from a variety of placements such as hospitals, therapy clinics, psychiatry offices, etc. Public schools must find a place for every child.
The thing that people need to realize with these students, especially EBD kids, too often because they appear to be quote-unquote normal kids, there's this perception that they intentionally misbehave and that they're naughty kids and they're intentionally difficult for staff, and that isn't true. If they had the skills or had the ability to manage any behavior, they would. One of these kids walks around and gets up in the morning and says, hey, I'm going to get up and just be a jerk to the whole world. They have a disability and they're not able to control those things.
I see staff in my district regularly who have scratches on their neck, bites on their arms, and who have been threatened verbally and physically by students.
It's not uncommon for me to have one or multiple accident reports to sign on a given day, because staff are consistently exposed to pinching, kicking, hitting,
because I had to go to the emergency room with having a phone that was hit in the head, stitches, concussions. We have had students that have been so intense in terms of their behavior that we've had to rotate staff in, two staff in every hour, so that they don't get burnt out, and we keep them safe and fresh, and it's a safe situation for the students and staff.
We have some close to danger all the time. This is a dangerous situation just for the staff. So when you see the calm and the kids sitting at the table, they're walking in and jerking around, what's the deal? It looks like it's really working. I continue on that and cheering around the studio.
Unfortunately, sometimes children who have mental health disorders act out against others. Most commonly, they are going to engage in behavior that's self-destructive. They're most harmful to themselves. But on occasion, they will lash out at others, and particularly children with neurobiological disorders. This is not volitional behavior. It is part of their disorder. So our staff are at risk and often do have glasses broken, get scratches and bites, other physical injuries. They have items thrown at them like chairs or books. That's the reality of a teacher's life in a classroom with children who are struggling with these various mental health issues.
Right now we have a very thin layer of mental health services that are co-located within some of our school programs. We understand that the funding for that is drying up very quickly, and we may lose 90% of the funding. That means we will have almost no co-located mental health services to serve these really high-need kids.
We have historically had a great funding base for co-located mental health services coming from local collaborative time study, or SCTS monies. And those are monies that are federal flow-through Title IV monies that basically go to support the work that we do addressing children's mental health needs in schools. And lately we have learned that we are going to have those funds cut dramatically due to some changes in Title IV as well as in the Medicaid claiming process. And because of those changes, we're very concerned about losing the fiscal funding base for our co-located mental health services. As we look at this visual, you can see that most of the services provided are shaded in red. Due to impending funding cuts, we anticipate that about 90% of those programs will disappear.
The increased reduction of public money for human services has resulted in fewer placements within correctional and residential treatment facilities. School districts are the only entity that must keep their doors open to such students. Human service cuts were implemented in order to save public tax dollars. I believe they now inadvertently are being spent out of K-12 general fund budgets.
Oftentimes, young people end up in our system with a very high emotional, social, and fiscal price tag. If we had early intervention that were appropriate, we could end up saving taxpayers millions of dollars.
Society and our communities. I would urge policymakers at the local, county, and state level to join me in this policy dialogue to come up with solutions.
Madam Chair. The reality I see as a school superintendent, and I know my colleagues in the other intermediates and in a number of the K-12 districts are experiencing this phenomenon at greater and lesser degrees. I'd like to show you just very briefly why I feel a school tragedy is not out of the reality for my school districts. And I'll just very briefly go over some facts of why I say that. The student population that we're responsible for has about 700 students in our six-hour special education programs. About 68% of those students are in our district because they display significant disruptive behavior and aggression. What we see are the population profile that you see up there on the screen, similar to what was said in the video. What's interesting is that in the 2003 session, the state legislature passed a law that basically indicated that school districts had to notify our staff when a violent student or a student with a history of violent behavior comes into our district. In my school district, because about 68% of the students are considered to have that profile, we reached an agreement with our teachers' union that we wouldn't do it for each and every one of those students. We would only notify them when an even more violent student than what is our norm comes into our school district. The kinds of things that we've seen this school year are up on the screen in front of you. You see the kinds of examples of students that we've notified our staff have coming in having a violent profile. These include students who have brought weapons to school, they've used scissors to hurt people, they do have sexual predator behaviors, and on and on and on. These are the kinds of students that we're seeing coming into the school district now. This was an example of a sixth grader who brought a pellet gun that was 18 inches long into a regular school, and he comes now into the intermediate school district. The kinds of things that we see in our secondary program for 1 month are listed on the screen coming up in front of you. These are actual police interventions and some of the reasons why the police intervened and the kind of property damage or assault damage to staff that we experienced in just a one-month period. Many of the threats are verbal, some are physical, some have sexual overtones. This is frankly the norm in one of our largest programs at this point. What I mentioned just a moment ago about notifying our staff only when for our school district we exceed a typical profile and we notify staff of a student coming in, we have seen a threefold increase from last year where we notified them about 5 students, and already this year we've had 15 students who have reached that level of notification. I have to tell you that this fall I took the first call from a mental health unit on a hospital ward saying to me that they were notifying our district under a statute of duty to warn that they had a fourth grader who was making very credible threats to kill our principal and our teacher, and they were returning the kid to school the next Monday. That is becoming part of our reality as an intermediate school district on behalf of not only our member districts, but again, districts who place students with us from across the state. These are the kinds of reasons we see for referral to our programs. We do a very, I think, courageous effort in serving these students. We do have very high staff ratios. We have specialized facilities. We do have police liaison officers in one or two of our buildings. We try to do a significant training, and still we come up with numerous staff accidents which are reportable under our reporting protocols within our district. What we do believe that we can do and we want to do, we do want to serve these students with the best research-based practices we can. We want to get quality staff in there. We want to do the right thing by these students, but what we need is a recognition that we are doing a different kind of educating than we were other years and have the kind of policy and funding support from the legislature that allow us to do the job with these students. So without taking more time, I do want to leave an opportunity for questions.
Thank you very much, Superintendent Lewandowski. And this is the third time I've seen that video, and it's still sobering to me. Representative DiRocolo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the testifier, I guess I don't know what the term is, but special needs children or students with mental health issues. Over the last 10 to 20 years, have we seen on a percentage basis an increase in the number of students who have been identified in those categories?
Superintendent Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe two things are operating. We do believe that the incidence of students with this type of special education need has increased, but we also believe that they are being increasingly served by the public schools as opposed to corrections and residential mental health treatment facilities. Frankly, the phenomenon that we think has happened is that different from when young people with cognitive disabilities decades ago were moved out of state institutions, there was a planful, intentional, and fully funded effort. We believe this has happened almost before our eyes, and perhaps together we have not realized what's happening, but kids are moving out of residential or correctional facilities into public schools, and we haven't recognized it to adequately prepare, fund, and train our staff to deal with these young people.
Madam Chair,
Representative Garofalo.
I haven't served on any of the health committees, so help me understand. In terms of the increase in these, you know, if we're to believe that there's a higher percentage of students and they're being treated in different fashions, we recognize that. Help me understand what the factors are, the causes that are driving this increase in this type of population.
Superintendent Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, I believe that there are two or three factors. For example, one thing we know is that there's an increase in autism. And autism has a significant factor in our district and at least some of our programs for some of these safety issues. We also know that there's an increase in fetal alcohol syndrome that is probably an underlying root cause in many of the special education disabilities that come through our doors. And then finally, I would attribute just some of the societal and cultural changes that we all recognize have happened over the last decade or two decades.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
And so, testifier, you mentioned societal and cultural differences, and my guess is you and I probably agree on those factors, but just for specificity purposes, could you list some of those societal and cultural differences again in your opinion that you think matter?
Superintendent Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, in my opinion, I believe items like increased illicit drug use, increase in access to weapons, among our communities, and the glorifying of violence that we see in the media and in other ways have all contributed to the types of issues that we see within this population.
And I would just add that I mentioned, I can't remember if it was this committee or a different one, but in case it wasn't this one, I've read some research articles recently given to me by the environmental finance chair here in the House that chemicals are damaging to young developing brains, and there is some evidence showing up that that is a contributor to autism and mental illness as well.
And Madam Chair, this is going to be a sensitive question, especially given the nice debate we just had on the House floor for a couple hours. but I couldn't help but notice that the population in that video was strongly disproportionately minority. And I know we have to be careful when we talk about these things, but I guess my first question is, number one, are minorities disproportionately served in the program? And the second question would be, if you had any insight as to why that's happening. And again, I respect the sensitive nature of it. If you prefer not to get into it, I totally understand.
Superintendent Lewandowski.
Madam Chair and Representative, I welcome the question. Yes, we see a disproportionate number of students of color within our special education programs. This is not unique to our intermediate. This is a national disproportionate number, and we're consistent with that national trend. I do believe that from my experience of about 30 years in education, that is quite likely tracked back to poverty and the surrounding types of challenges that come out of that, including drug use, challenging work environments for the parents, all the kinds of things that go along with poverty are probably tracking back to seeing this kind of disproportionate number of kids of color.
And Madam Chair, my final question.
Gretchen Garofalo.
In your experience in dealing with at-risk individuals, do you see a strong correlation between the number of parents in the household, or I suppose you probably don't see whether they're born out of wedlock or not, but the number of parents in the household, those growing up in single-parent families versus two-parent families?
Madam Chair, Representative, while I'm sure that we have a disproportionate number of students that come from that kind of household, that would not be a factor I'd put at the top of the list at all.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Good questions. Representative Detmer, followed by Representative Heidgerken.
Madam Chair and Superintendent, how do you measure your success of your program?
Superintendent Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, Representative, very good question. Our fundamental success right now is if we keep young people safe and our staff safe. And I don't say that lightly. That is a reality for us. We are right now positioned to think of that first. However, that being said, we are very excited about new models that we believe have great promise for these young people. We see a combination of thinking of education and mental health in one approach. And frankly, should the legislature find it successful to pass the Safe Schools Levy, we would look at ways of bringing non-traditional mental health services into our schools and combine it with academics that are very hands-on and experiential. We would bring, frankly, some additional career tech vocational types of opportunities right into our programs. We find giving hope to these young people with hands-on types of experiences where they can see forward a way to get jobs in the future has been tremendously powerful with these young people. We know that if we can give them a skill, we found a way to unlock their door to success. And so that's how we are measuring our success right now, is academics through hands-on vocational kinds of training.
Representative McFarland wanted to respond, and then we'll go back to your follow-up. Representative McFarland.
I really have a question that I'd like for you to answer to clarify for people. My understanding is that the home district is the one that's paying the tuition for these students to come to your facility.
Superintendent Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct, and we always bill back to the district of residence, and that is, again, why we will find kids coming into our district from beyond our members, because their parents are living in another part of the state. We do serve a number of Minneapolis and outstate students, and for the record, the average tuition for the students you saw in the video is around $40,000 to $60,000 per student for one school year. And that is what it takes to both keep people safe and to move forward kids academically and vocationally.
Prevention would be a lot cheaper.
Madam Chair, I agree.
Representative Detmer, follow up.
Does your staff, do they have specialized licensure training, or are they certified differently than a normal public education teacher?
Superintendent Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, Representative, all of our staff, licensed staff, are licensed according to the Department of Education requirements for special education. We have a range of licensure areas, but it's all follows the requirements of the legislation and the Department of Education. Right now, we have about an equal number of licensed staff and non-licensed staff that we use in many of our special education programs. Just again to give you a sense of why we might need the kinds of ratios that you saw up there, I mentioned that in the PowerPoint that it was about a 4-to-1 licensed staff. We would at the same time have about a 1-to-4 non-licensed staff, and so that means that for every student there, for every four students there's probably two staff, one licensed and one non-licensed. But what I can tell you is when we get into a crisis situation with a student, whether it's a student with severe autism or a student who's very aggressive and is threatening to a staff person, we often will have to have 4 to 6 adult staff to restrain that type of student.
We have three more questioners. and I would like to finish up this bill very soon, and we have need to see if there's any public testimony as well. We want to take a little time to go over the governor's bill that was introduced yesterday. So we have Representative Heidgerken, Dominguez, and Mariani. And I didn't see the third one, but I think we're going to cut off because we won't have time otherwise. So, Representative, if you could be real fast for a change, Representative Heidgerken.
That's very difficult to do.
No. I have the same problem.
And I don't have a question. I have more of a comment. And it's something that we have to be very careful when they're funding all students. We can establish some intermediate school districts outstate. We did have two casualties the last couple of years, one over at Cold Spring. Both of them happened in greater Minnesota, and the other one at Red Lake. But again, we have to realize that this is not, I saw the PowerPoint here, but we do have those problems in rural Minnesota as well. My daughter works with those students. These are first and second graders coming in swearing and everything else. Everything I heard there, I heard in the first and second grade. And this is in a greater Minnesota school district. So we do have those issues as well, just so you know that.
Thank you. That was a very nice short point, and thank you for that. Rep. Sam Dominguez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question you may have already asked or answered, from my colleagues, but my question would probably be on the composition of your staff. This is not a new program. But I didn't see a lot of composition of staff that are being trained, maybe bilingually, maybe cultural differences, as we, one of the representatives have brought up. What are you doing to accomplish that steps as far as bringing in organizations or staff members that could help within your school district?
Superintendent Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, Representative, excellent question. Part of what we've tried to do over the last few years is address that very real need, and I would mention two or three ways. One, we specifically have hired a diversity coordinator and recruitment specialist to go out into communities of color and seek individuals to work in a variety of our different programs. Additionally, when we've secured co-located partnerships with mental health agencies, everyone comes with the requirement of culturally competent approaches, and we intentionally are seeking out agencies that specialize in different communities of color and have done quite a good job of recruiting agencies for that very reason. But we do have additional work to do with our staff, and every opportunity we get as staff turnover, we work on bringing in a more diverse staff to address that very real issue.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Rood and McClellan, thank you for bringing us a very important issue that we have not spent enough time in this body deliberating and owning, and I appreciate that opportunity to do that. Madam Chair, we talk about the special ed cross-subsidy, and it occurred to me as Ms. Lewandowski was speaking that we also should be talking perhaps in this body about a mental health cross-subsidy. There was reference in the film to cuts in human services over the past few years that have contributed to lower services for students, which then are trying to be met in your schools, in the intermediary schools. My question, I have two very quickly. One is the safe school levy, this new additional levy, is it meant to cover new costs related to this reality, all new costs related to this reality? What I'm getting at is there still a large chunk of sort of a uncovered cost subsidy at play here? The state school levy is prescribed for certain activities and not for others. And so I'm just trying to get a sense of the scope and, in terms of trying to address this issue, will this levy address all that issue in terms of that unmet cross-subsidy, quote-unquote? And then my other question very quickly is the additional levy meant to go dollar to dollar to the intermediaries through the school districts? I wasn't quite sure, what the... Because the intermediaries don't have the levy authority, and so I understand why it's structured this way, but is the intent then the pass dollar for dollar those dollars from the districts to the intermediaries.
Superintendent Lewandowski.
Madam Chair and Representative, I'll answer your second question first. Yes, the intent is that while the additional dollars would flow to our members, they would transfer it to the intermediates, so it would be dedicated money to the intermediates. And secondly, I really appreciate the opportunity to answer your first question, because I do believe that this would not be sufficient to cover all the shifts that we've seen of mental health services needed for this population or the broader population that was brought up earlier. I do believe that increasingly schools are the provider of mental health for the young people, and that recognition of the shift that has occurred over time would be a great step forward, such that we acknowledge schools and educators are providing the type of support that we see our young people needing when they come through our doors. The language in this bill, I believe, would, for the purposes of the intermediates, take us a huge step forward, and we believe that we could additionally provide some of those types of services under the current language. But I believe that a further policy discussion in Human Services and Education Committees would be a very worthwhile discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Representative McFarland and Representative Brood and I and others on this committee actually serve on the mental health division that we have for the first time this year, which is meant to be a cross-jurisdictional committee, so that we're looking at, you know, all the various committees and how they impact, how mental illness impacts our budgets. And so this is a very good precursor. I know we will be talking about this issue some more in Representative Dominguez's subcommittee and then later in this committee. And I think, you know, while I'm chair, we'll be covering this topic maybe more than before. So, Representative Mariani, thank you for that. And thank you for this bill. I would like to ask now for any public testimony from the audience. Okay, thank you very much. Representative McFarland.
Yes. I'd like to speak in support of this, but I also want to people to know that this is not the only thing that intermediate school districts do. It is half of what they do, but they are also career and tech schools, and they cover special education services for birth to 21 in a variety of areas, helping those school districts that can't provide those services in their home districts. So I just wanted to make sure that you knew that they were more than just this, and also that there are other models like this around the state with cooperatives and consortium, so other students are being covered throughout the state.
Thank you. And before we lay this over, since there wasn't any public testimony, I didn't call on Representative Morrow, and Representative Erickson has just raised her hand, so I'm going to take two more questions that we now have time for. Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As a former chair of a very similar district down in South Central Minnesota, I applaud the work that you all are doing. And we talked about some factors that might be contributing to the rise in the population. I'm wondering if the testifiers might be able to comment on whether access to affordable health care, including mental health care, and affordable housing might be also contributing factors to the rise in the population.
Superintendent Lewandowski, or did you mean for the legislature?
Ms. Lewandowski.
Lewandowski. Okay.
Madam Chair, I would certainly agree with the representative that those are two very important contributing factors.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Garland. I really am going to provide the segue to the governor's bill, because when we get there, we'll find that in Article 9, one of his provisions is the Minnesota Fatherhood Leadership Initiative. I know Representative Mariani must know about this, but this I see as some hope, too, to helping in the situations that we've just watched on video. A lot of these young men and women do not have fathers in their homes, and I'm hoping that we can look at an initiative such as the governor's listed on page 73 and following as offering us some hope and some encouragement for leading these young people to a better life.
Thank you very much, Representative Erickson, and having you speak up reminds me we also have a mental health caucus in this legislature that Representative Erickson, I think, has perfect attendance at or close to it, and so members who are not on the mental health division but want to learn more about various topics that have to do with mental health, that's a very good place to go as well. Well, now, with the time that we have left, about 10 minutes, I've asked Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom to just give us the highlights. You have the governor's bill in your packets, House File 840, thank you, I'm looking right at it, and I still can't get it right. And so they have gone through it, and we all have heard the governor's presentation, but on reading of the bill, there are a few things that I would like them to share with us, and then when we can have questions. So Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom? Even they don't know who's going to start this time. Not just me.
Madam Chair, members, there wasn't a lot that we haven't talked about when we went through the budget book. There are a couple of sections we thought it might be interesting for you to look at. I point you to page 8. Section 11, and this ties in a bit with the discussion that was occurring this morning with Representative Dominguez's bill with extended time revenue. The governor's proposal, as you might remember, was to expand extended time ADMs up to 1.5 from the current limit of 1.2, and the governor also inflates by 2% the formula allowance, but there are some changes on 824 to 828 that might be of interest to you all that were not in Representative Dominguez's bill. That one, the change on 826, which provides for additional pupil transportation costs attributable to these programs, is a technical change. They've allowed districts to fund these, to use this revenue for these costs, but this just clarifies that. Then the changes on 27 and 28 are in response to some concerns expressed by some of the programs about how much funding was being passed through to them by individual school districts and would limit the amount of revenue that school districts could retain for administrative purposes. So it's a little bit more in that language than is in the budget book as it was presented to you. There are some other changes in the language related to that program. I won't go through those in detail, but they are on... where'd they go? Page 4? Yeah, on page 4.
And while they're thinking, Committee Administrator Patrick has just put a note in my ear. These aren't really the highlights of the governor's bill. They're details that we already know the highlights, but these are some details that we haven't heard before. And I thought that last detail was a good one.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, the governor's on page 12 and 13, the basic alternative teacher compensation aid sections, the QCOMP program changes that the governor proposes. You can see on page 13 the change related to the charter schools and...
It's good to know that
bottom of page 12.
We all talk to ourselves, and Mr. Crow is doing that for us right now.
Am I saying all this out loud?
Yes, sure.
it's a mental dialogue.
Yeah.
The bottom of page 12 highlights the changing of the cap as it reflects, the governor's proposal to change the cap as it relates to charter schools and their participation in the QCOMP program. Flip through quick and see if there's anything else. I think that's it for the low lights on Article 1.
Very good. And Mr. Crow, are you doing, or Mr. Strom, are you doing Article 2?
Madam Chair, I think in Article 2 there's really nothing there that jumped out of this morning different from what was in the budget book presentations. No details there that are surprising. We'll dig into those programs in more detail as we go through this bill. But in Article 3, which starts on the bottom of, or in the middle of page 41, this is the special education article. And a couple of issues to point out here, probably the biggest of which that was not in the initial governor's budget presentation, probably for time reasons, begins on page 50. This is section 9 of the bill, and this has to do with the maintenance of effort. As committee members are aware, the governor's increasing the special ed costs by 2%, base budget by 2% per year, but only for the next 2 years. And you can see on lines 50.26, the beginning in 2010 will again run into some issues regarding maintenance of effort if that level of funding is held flat. And this is the process the department's putting in place to try and minimize that impact of the federal maintenance of effort requirements on special ed, which occur when we freeze the statewide total amount of special education.
And
Mr. Crump.
Madam Chair and members, then in Article 4, a couple of sections you might be interested in relate to the new technology programs. If you look on page 55 through 58, there's the detail there on, as you probably remember, there's $19 million a year for technology funding. It's divided about $16.5 million for the technology grants in Section 4, and you can see kind of how those are going out and what the process is. That you can get some detail if you were wondering how that funding was going to get out to school districts. And then in Section 5, the $2.5 million of that $19 million is for online learning expansion, and you can see how the governor is proposing to target what kind of programs the governor is proposing to target that funding to, and then how the grant awards will be made, how the money will actually go out.
Madam Chair and members, Article 5, for reasons that are still unclear to Mr. Crow and me, we group nutrition and accounting issues together in this article, and Section 1 has to do with the percent of money that's spent on the classroom expenditures. This is essentially the sum of 70%. So this probably wasn't talked about much when the budget overview was presented. There's not a fiscal implication to this, but this is the language that's being proposed related to the percent of classroom expenditures that are spent as direct classroom expenditures.
Mr. Trom, where has accounting usually been?
Madam Chair, this is where it always is, but it's just an odd coupling to put nutrition and accounting together.
So. Madam Chair, he's not saying we don't understand it because it's in here. We've done it for years this way, and it's our fault, but we don't understand why we do it.
Oh, I see. We never understand it. It's nothing new. I was going
right. to
put Ms. Swanson on the spot and say, why in the world now? Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair and members, Article 6 is the library's article that... There isn't much there to look at. You can see the study is really the only language that's in there if you're curious about that study that the governor proposed. And
then, Madam Chair, Article 10 on page 75 is the state agency budget. And just a couple of things to point out here. These were brought up during the budget hearing for the rulemaking authority, which is under page 76. For the career and technical and the graduation standards, the department expects those to cost $200,000 each for each of those two rule modifications. And I think we've had a little discussion of perhaps there could be some ways to do that other than going through the full-blown rulemaking procedure, particularly for the career and technical rule. And then secondly, if you look on the last page on page 77, you can see some appropriations here to the Department of Public Safety. And Mr. Crow might want to mention the process that's going to happen here, but essentially those will be moved from your jurisdiction to the committee that deals with those issues.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, Mr. if you look on Crow. Page 75, there's a $3 fee that's appropriated for parenting time centers, and that's where it's amended to be moved from the Commissioner of Education to the Commissioner of Public Safety. Right now, there's an interagency agreement that transfers that. This would just take out of education's jurisdiction and put it into public safety. So it's likely that this will get in the appropriation on page 77 will get moved to the public safety to the Judiciary Committee budget.
Thank you very much. And we don't have time for questions, but just to give Ms. Swanson up there for the department a heads up, Strom was referring to the rulemaking. We noticed in the budget book that it was all laid out there, and we're wondering why we just couldn't put it in by reference into the rules without having to pay all that extra money. So we'll ask you can tell us the answer to that later. Thank you, members. The meeting's adjourned.